Okay, welcome to Exploration 1, Module 9, with some flow-over stuff from Module 8. We're going to talk briefly about the types of encoding and stuff, because Ian's got other things to do this morning. He always has other things to do. So we'll get his bit out of the way, because he knows about it better than I do. And then we will move on to Chapter 9, which deals with Ethernet.
Okay, I'm on. How's the volume level? All right?
It's good.
Okay, so we're talking about data encoding. Now, the reason we do data encoding is because as we increase the rate, the cabling basically can't handle the higher frequency of the changes. So if we look at the very simple form of encoding, where we're sending a series of ones and zeros down a wire, so we're just going to make a 1 being 5 volts and a 0 being 0 volts. For every bit that we're sending, we need to send one change. This is fine in either low-speed transmissions like your normal RS-232, the serial communications, where we do that. Matter of fact, in the serial, we use plus 12 and minus 12 volts for the 1 and 0. But it can cause some issues. It's very hard to have a clock synchronized to another machine, another clock, some distance away. All clocks will drift out of synchronization. So we've got to have some way of resynchronizing our clocks together. So, one of the ways we can do this is with Manchester encoding. Manchester encoding is a fairly simple concept that makes sure that there is a transition in every bit that you're sending. Now, I'll go more into that in a second. If we're sending just the very simple signal where 1 is 5 volts, 0 is 0 volts, if we have a long string of 1s, we can't really tell where one begins and the next one begins. So as our clocks drift out of synchronization, we can end up sampling at the wrong times and end up sending what we think is sending, say, 100 ones, and the receiver thinks you've only sent 99, because there's no change. You can't tell the difference between each of the bits. So what we do in Manchester encoding is we make sure there is a transition, a voltage change, at every bit that we transmit. So for normal Manchester, there's a couple of different types, but we'll only do the one to get the concept across. The transitions signify whether we are sending a 0 or a 1. It doesn't matter what voltage level we're actually transmitting. We're only looking for this transition from or a change in the voltage on the line. So the transitions occur at the middle of a transmission period, a bit period. Now, does everyone know what a bit period means?
You mean the duration of the voltage across the line that will be applied or something?
That's correct. So if we're sending 100 bits per second, a bit period is 1/100th of a second. So it's how long that bit is being transmitted for. So in Manchester encoding, during that bit period, we must have a transition. The transition itself is... where did I write that down? Okay, in the case of a 1, we will have a transition in the middle of the bit period from a high voltage to a low voltage, and that signifies that there is a 1. If we have a 0, we have a transition from a low voltage to a high voltage in the middle of a transition. Now, this means that if we're going from a 1 to a 0, we may need to change the voltage at the beginning of the bit period. That actually carries no information. It's only the transition in the middle that carries the information, and whether it goes from a low to a high or a high to a low. Now, what that means is, because we have a transition in the middle of each bit period, we can resynchronize our clocks on every single bit, because we expect this transition to happen at a given time. So we can resynchronize clocks. And that's the only reason it's used. The major disadvantage of this is because we have to have a transition in every single bit, and quite often we have to have a transition at the beginning of a bit to get the state ready, we're actually doubling the required bandwidth of the communication channel, because there is quite often two transitions per bit. One to prepare for the information transition to get us to the right voltage to begin with, and then the transition that carries the information. So it has a disadvantage of doubling the bandwidth that's required. One very common encoding method that overcomes this, but doesn't overcome the issue with long strings of zeros or ones, is MLT3. Now, MLT3 is used in 100 meg Ethernet. And all it is very simply, multi-level transmission, MLT. And the three stands for the three levels. The way it works is we have three voltage levels, usually a negative voltage, a zero voltage, and a positive voltage. And we use a change in the state, change in the level, to transmit a one. If there is no change in the level, we transmit a zero. So if we're sending 1, 1, 1, we would start at a negative voltage, then we would change to 0 volts, then we would change to a positive voltage, and that would transmit 1, 1, 1. If we're transmitting 0, 0, 0, there would be no voltage change from whatever level we were at. This method actually decreases the required bandwidth because we're not cycling through a full negative, zero, positive, zero, negative cycle for each bit. We are only doing that when we're transmitting a one. So it extends out the available bandwidth. There are other methods of encoding as well, including NRZI, which is non-return to zero. And basically, that's exactly what it is. It doesn't return to zero to transmit a bit. Ones we won't actually talk about a great deal is the 8B6T encoding algorithms and the similar ones. Basically, these are used to increase the channel width or your available data stream by breaking the transmission up into multiple channels. In the case of 8B6T, it takes the output from the MAC layer, breaks it into the bytes into the nibbles, puts it through an encoder which takes the 8 bits in that byte and turns it into three lots of 6 bits to be transmitted over the three channels. This is done for redundancy, so we have extra data in there for error detection and correction, and also to increase the bandwidth. So our three channels would have 25 megabits each. Certainly, go ahead.
Okay, when you said three channels, are you saying that the frequencies along the wire will change to make three channels, or is it that you will use multiple cores for transmission?
That very much depends on the transmission media that you're using. Generally, it will just multiplex three channels onto one wire pair, but in some cases it can be three different wires. Very much dependent on the standard and the media that you're using. Okay, so that's pretty much all it is. If we just think of Manchester encoding as we need to transmit a transition to convey the data from either zero or a negative value to a positive value to indicate a zero, or a positive value to a negative value to indicate a one. And that is done so that we can resynchronize our timing. There are a couple of different Manchester encodings. The first one is the standard Manchester, which was created by a fellow by the name of Thomas. I think he was a mathematician. The one that's actually used in Ethernet is very similar to it, except it's reversed. It uses the transitions from a negative to a positive for a 1, and a transition from a positive to a negative for a 0, so it's just inverted. There's also differential Manchester, which I won't go into, and it's just a slightly modified version of the standard Manchester. That's really all about there is to it. The encoding itself, particularly when you get into the higher speed, becomes very complicated. But the Manchester and NRZI and MLT3, they're fairly straightforward. Is there any questions on that?
I don't think it's heavily tested, but I thought we should probably cover it anyway. Especially for people like Pranav, who tend to be mega curious.
It's probably not in there at all, in fact. The only thing to remember as far as networking in practice goes that the signals are encoded. They are not raw ones and zeros that you're sending down a piece of wire, because that's extremely unreliable and also very, very low speed. And this sort of encoding is used in almost every form of data transmission. If you look at the signals that come out of a hard drive through the SATA port, that's serial data, but it's encoded in a very, very tricky way to get enough data bits down a very limited bandwidth cable. If we think of the standard Cat5 cable, that only has a bandwidth of 25 megahertz. So we could only send 25 million bits per second down that wire. But somehow we managed to send 100 bits per second down that wire, and that is done through clever encoding. And it's the same with the gigabit Ethernet. That's just a clever encoding as well, and using all four pairs. The tricky bit, of course, is using all four pairs and having it transmit full duplex.
They mention that in Chapter 9, but I don't believe they test it. They just mention it to show how complex gigabit is.
It is. We've got students who do their doctoral research just on encoding methods.
All right. Everybody relatively happy with that? Thank you, Mr. Murray.
No problems. Have fun.
Okay, now back to this pesky binary exercise that I set you all. I'm just going to have a quick look at the second last question before I do the last question. Is anybody having trouble figuring out how to find out which netmask to have for a certain number of hosts? So if I want a netmask that will support 25 hosts, can anybody tell me how I'd figure that out? Anybody? Or do we all not know? It's okay if we all don't know.
Look for the next highest step. Let's say the right word.
Use a binary conversion to figure out how many bits are in the network portion of the subnet mask.
That's partially correct, yeah. So if we want to find a subnet mask that would take 32 hosts, how would we go about that? Any ideas, Drew, or do I need to go through it? Somebody had mic'd up, but I wasn't sure who it was, and they were fairly quiet.
Yeah, sorry about that, Kerry.
Oh, that's better. Now I can hear you. Sorry about that. I sort of heard you there in the background, but I wasn't quite sure what you were saying.
Away from my mic, sorry. I was saying... You look for the next highest square to the power of two.
Power of two.
Which would be what?
32.
Five.
Yeah, 2 to the power of 5. Right. Yep.
Mm-hmm. So that tells you how many hosts, correct?
That tells you how many bits are going to be in the host portion, which, once you know how many bits are going to be in the host portion, you can then figure out how many bits are going to be in the network portion. So if we have 5 bits in the network portion and 27 bits in the host portion, we then write down the binary with 27 ones and 5 zeros, and then if we convert that back to decimal, we would get our subnet mask. So if we've got 27 ones and 5 zeros, we have 8 ones, 8 ones, 8 ones for the first 24 of them, so that's 255.255.255. We then have 3 ones, which is 128, 64, and 32, which gets us to 192, and 5 zeros, so our subnet mask ends up being 255.255.255.192. Now, I can just see you're all brimming with understanding there, so how about I do another one?
Now, you know, I got bitten on this one in your last question in the assignment. I think I goofed up the conversion somewhere, but this is the procedure I followed.
Okay, this is the second last question we're looking at the moment. The assignment sort of goes a bit beyond what their regular assignment does, but I figure it's mathematics that you're all going to have to do at some point anyway. So we throw it in and see how we go, and it sort of helps with the understanding of how the mechanics of the thing works. All right, so let's say we want 86 hosts. Can somebody other than Sam tell me how you would do it? And Sam's just getting omitted this time because he almost got it right last time. Well done.
Okay. So the highest power of 2, which will accommodate 86 hosts, is 128. So that's 2 to the power of 7. And so we need 7 host bits. 32 minus 7 is, ouch, how much?
25.
2 minus 25, okay. So 25 network bits, and you have 7 host bits, so we write down 25 ones and 7 zeros. You have 255.255.255, which takes you to 24, then another 1, and the rest are all zeros. Now, question here. Do I just convert that 1 to decimal, or what?
So you convert the 1000000 to, from binary to decimal. So you convert 1 and 7 zeros to binary, which last time I looked would give you the number 128.
Yeah, I think that's what I did, but you didn't do something like this in the previous one, right? You took only the network portion in the previous question.
No, I took it in both. I can also show you guys a shortcut too, and this is probably worth keeping in mind. With this particular question, because the number of hosts is small, it's worth noticing that if you subtract the number of host bits you've got from the network bits that you've got, that will also give you the result. So, for example, if you've got 128 hosts, and you say 256 minus 128, you'll be left with 128, which will be the last octet of your network mask, plus the three lots of 255 that precede it. So that's a shortcut way of working it out.
If it's 128, so, I thought it would be 255.
Can we do another one?
Zero.
It was 255. No, 255 would give you 256 combinations with 254 possible hosts. We only want 128 hosts.
This is something, because I was minusing the host bits from the last thing, because I was going 255. Minus 1, minus 2, minus 4, minus 8, minus 16, minus 13, 32, minus 64, minus 128, which would be 0. So I missed something.
Okay. You have to take it from 256 because you need it's 0 okay. to 255, which means you've got 256 combinations, which is why it's 0 to 255, 256 combinations. So you subtract 256 minus 128, and you get 128. Okay, let's say we've got 60. Yeah, we're doing another one, Curtis. It's all right. Let's say we've got 60 hosts. What's the next higher power of 2 above 60?
64.
Correct. Wrong, Drew. Smack.
Yes. That was bad.
That's all right. We'll forgive you. 64. So, we have how many bits of host portion if we have a power of 64, if we have the answer 64? 2 to the power of what gives us 64? 6? Okay. Yep. And 32 minus 6, last time I checked, was 26?
6.
Yep.
28.
Hang on. 26.
26.
Yeah. 32 minus 6 is 26.
Yeah, never mind, I'm slow at math.
Windows Calculator told me it was, and I believe Microsoft, which is very silly because there were bugs in Windows Calculator in Windows 95. Go and look up bugs in Windows Calculator if you get bored. It had floating point problems. There are also bugs in Excel, but let's not go there. Okay, so we have 26 bits of network portion, and we have 6 bits of host portion. Remember I said that if we say 256 minus 2 to the power of 6, so 256 minus 64 will give us 192. Everybody happy with that?
Mm-hmm.
Which gives us 255.255.255.192. There's your answer. Alright, let's do another one because we're here. 507 hosts, just to make life a little bit more complex. 507 hosts. Next power of 2 above 507 that will hold our 507 hosts.
512, which is 2 to the power of 9.
That's correct. So, we have 9 host bits. We have how many network bits? 9 and what makes 32?
23.
Alright. So we write 255.255 because that gives us 16 of them. We then put another 7 ones, which will get us to 254. Yep, because 128 plus 64 is 192 plus 32 is 224 plus gets you to 254, and then the last 9 bits are set to 0, so then we put 0. So we end up with a subnet mask of 255.255.254.0. Now with this one, because we actually have a bigger quantity than 256, you would actually have to subtract it from a bigger quantity. I'm just trying to figure out how the mechanics of that would work.
So we're figuring out the third pair?
You would actually have to subtract the 512 hosts from 65,536, and then you would have to convert 65,024 to binary, which is just not worth it. But that's how you do it.
So it's 255.255.254.0.
That's correct.
Okay. I see. So for each one, it's like taking a lot of 255, and then that goes down one. Okay.
Now, what if we had 3,000 hosts?
4,096, which is 12 network bits, or host bits, rather.
Yep, 12 network bits. How many?
20 host bits.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. Now, 20 host bits is going to be pretty easy, because we have 255.255 gives us 16. We then have 128, 64... 32 and 16, which gets us to 240. So we end up with 255.255.240.0. Anybody at all confused about that procedure? Anybody want some clarifications? Basically, what you're doing, guys, is you're figuring out how many bits are for the host. You're setting all of those to 0. You're figuring out how many bits are the network. You're setting all those to 1s. And you are converting that to binary. To decimal, and the fact that it's in 4 octets or dotted decimal notation means you can convert it byte by byte. And if there's 8 ones, you convert that to 255. If there's less than 8 ones in a particular octet, you need to convert that octet and then write them out. And remembering, in a network mask, all of the network bits have to be on the left, and all of the host bits have to be on the right.
I think I finally got the hang of subnetting now. I mean, it's taken me a long time, but I think I finally got it.
Okay, so let's do the last question in the exercise that I set. Has anybody got any final comments on how to calculate the size of the net masks? Now, you guys, if you don't ask me any questions on this, and you don't chase me up on Skype or drop me an email, I'm going to assume you guys know it. Just be aware of that. Okay, so if you do have any questions, you don't have to ask them in front of the whole class. You can catch me up on Skype or drop me an email or catch me up off lecture. But if this procedure is confusing you, it is in your best interests to unravel the confusion in the next week or two. Okay, so everybody cool with that?
I know I understand it. It just takes me a few minutes to call the relevant information up in my brain so that I'm thinking about it in the right way.
Well, as I say, practice makes perfect. Started subnetting back in 1995, and I will fully admit that I really didn't do it very well back in 1995. The years have marched by, and I've had a little bit more practice, and I occasionally still get them wrong. Now, has anybody played with Jackie's notepad scripts that are up on qcat.org that read the current character rather than the whole line as you go up and down in Jaws? Anybody had a tamper with those?
I installed them, but I couldn't get them to work.
Alright, I'll look into that. It should work with notepad.exe. Alt up arrow and alt down arrow. Well, that's probably worth mentioning. Does it say that anywhere in the documentation that comes with the scripts, or did you just happen to know because you read the source?
No, I knew it. I hit Josky H for help, and it's right there.
I did read
the source also later.
Fair enough. Alright, so there you go. That's why they wouldn't have worked. Alt up arrow and alt down arrow will move you up and down and read the character that you land on, which is probably a good idea because that way it won't interfere with the existing notepad bindings. So, give that a shot, Melanie, and see if they work after you do that. And then if they still don't work, get back to us. I will have a look at the archive, and if that fact is not mentioned in the documentation that comes with the scripts, apart from the Insert H help, I will write a little file to put it along with the scripts, because even I forget to press Insert H a lot of the time.
I just tried it. It works.
Good. I think the other gotcha is if you've got your... if you've got your verbosity set to intermediate or advanced, which is one of the things, I usually set mine to intermediate, sometimes JAWS doesn't speak those context help messages. I think it does speak the Insert H one, so I would have no excuse in that particular instance. But if the verbosity is set to advanced, it won't actually tell you that, so something to be aware of. All right, let's have a look at the last question in this assignment. We have the network 192.168.4.0. Subnetted with a mask of 255.255.254.0. Before I go any further, how many hosts could we have on this subnet?
I have 12.
Anyone else agree with Drew?
5, 10.
Yeah, 5, 10 hosts.
Take the chance to agree with me. Yeah, 510, that's right.
510 hosts, yeah, that's correct.
Yeah, that's it.
That's 510 because we have 9 bits of host, and 2 to the power of 9 is 512. 2 to the power of H minus 2, where H is the number of host bits, is 2 to the power of 9 minus 2 is 510. Alrighty. Now, before we go on any further, 512 combinations or 510 IP addresses, can anybody tell me how much subnet space is that, if anybody even understands the question I'm asking? If we have 512 combinations, how many type of what class network are we working with?
Two class C's.
That's correct. Can anybody else see that?
Yep.
So in other words, if we look at the network range, we're looking at 192.168.4.0 to 192.168.4.255, and then we've got 192.168.5.0 to 192.168.5.255. So the actual network range runs from 192.168.4.0 to 192.168.5.255. Everybody happy with that?
255 is a broadcast, though, isn't it? 5.255 is a broadcast address?
That's right, but I was giving you the actual host range is 192.168.4.1 to 192.168.5.254. Well spotted. I'm just giving you the entire range of the subnet space, including the network and broadcast addresses.
Isn't that a class C?
Two class C's, Josh. Because we have one class C at 192.168.4.0/24 and 192.168.5.0/24, which gives us 256 plus 256 is 512 combinations minus the two reserved ones, which is 510 hosts. Now, the thing that's worth mentioning here is that in the network 192.168.4.0/23, 192.168.4.255 is a valid IP address. True or false?
False.
True.
Remember that when we have an IP subnet, we have two reserved addresses where all of the host bits are set to zero. In our particular example, 192.168.4.0, and all of the host bits set to 1, which is our broadcast address, 192.168.4.255. 5.255. So we have a situation where .5.0 is a valid IP address, .4.255 is a valid IP address. So just because you see 0 in the last octet, don't assume the address is invalid until you've checked the subnet mask. That is a little bit of a gotcha. Alright, let's work through this. We have this mythical subnet, and we want 250 hosts. Alright guys, what sort of network are we going to need to have 250 hosts?
Class C.
Anybody else agree with Josh? Sorry, Joshua I should say. I shouldn't shorten your name.
Yes.
It's fine, Josh. Yes, it doesn't matter to me.
Okay, as long as I don't call you late for dinner. Right, because, well, okay, we look at this, the next power of 2 above 250 is 256, and 256 is 2 to the power of 8. 2 to the power of 8 minus 2 is 254, so we have 254 hosts on the Class C subnet for our subnet. Everybody happy with that so far?
Yeah.
Alright, so let's start slicing up the range. If we need 256 hosts or a Class C, why don't we allocate the first subnet to 192.168.4.0/255.255.255.0. Everybody happy with that?
Yes.
Yes.
Alright, what is the maximum usable subnet host address in that network? Can anybody tell me what type the number of the maximum usable host address in that subnet into the chat window? It's just the last octet of it. We have an answer from Brian. Anybody else want to have a shot? Yep. If you had your money banked on Brian and Pranav in this particular instance, you wouldn't be singing for your supper this evening. So, well done. So, that's our first subnet done. Okay, now we want 20 hosts. Anybody tell me what's the next power of 2 above 20 that would let us have 20 hosts?
32.
Alright. Anybody tell me what the subnet mask for that would be? Yep, 2 to the power of 5 is 32. So we have 255.255.255. What? Can anybody tell me? We have 3 ones and 5 zeros.
That would be, let's see, 128, 192, yeah, it would be 224.
I'll go with that. 255.255.255.224. Alright. Does everybody agree that if we start our 32 address subnet at 0, 192.168.5.0, we would have a range of 192.168.5.0 to 192.168.5.31. And we would then, .30. And the network address would be 0, and the broadcast address would be 31, and we'd have a subnet mask of 255.255.255.224.
Sounds good.
Yes, I have a question, however.
Well, in that case, you should possibly ask it.
Okay, so, the 192.168.0. Zero to 192.168.0.31. That's one network, and then the next number up would be 192.168.0.32, and that'd be on a completely different network. Is that right?
It would be. However, we have a little wrinkle in our last question that I just noticed, which is what may confuse some people. We want a group of 90 hosts. So, what power of 2 would we need for 90 hosts?
128.
Yeah, which last time I checked was 2 to the power of 7. Everybody happy with that? Okay.
Yes.
If we need 90 hosts, and we've already used from 192.168.5.0 to 192.168.5.31, does everybody agree that if I wanted to use this 128 subnet, because I've used the bottom half of the address range, I'm going to have to start the top range at 128 and go through to 254?
Yeah, okay.
So, our final subnet is 192.168.5.128 slash 255.255.255.128. And that would be give us our 90 hosts at the top of the subnet range. I'm almost going to have to write up a second exercise now that I've gone through all of these ones with you. Probably shouldn't be that nasty.
But wait a minute. If you have the 1.2 and say 1.31, you know, and you said that 31 is on a separate network, why can't you use 1.2.168, 1.31 up to 1.127?
Because last time I checked, 128 minus 32. You could actually. No, hang on. 128 minus 32 is only 96. Oh, yeah, you could do that. Oh, hang on though, Josh. No, you can't. Because you can't start at 32 and go to. And go to 128, because you would need, if you wanted to do that, you'd actually need to break it into three more subnets of 32. Does anybody understand what I'm saying?
Yeah, but why would you want to break it? It's 90 hosts, right? So can't you just pick up the entire range? Or is it because of the mask?
It's because of the mask. If you have a subnet mask of 255.255.255.128, that will immediately give you the range from 0 to 128 on the 5.0 range, or 0 to 127, I should say, or the range 128 to 255. But if you set the subnet mask to 255.255.255.224, you end up with a situation where the range goes from 0 to 31, 32 to 63, 64 to 95. In other words, that subnet mask will restrict you to talking to 32 hosts at a time. And my question told you that I wanted 90 hosts on that subnet.
How do you select exactly what range it is? Does it do that on its own, or is that something you select in like the router configuration usually?
Well, the actual network address sets the bottom of the range. So in our particular instance, the network address would be 192.168.5.128. And then the subnet mask for the route would be 255.255.255.128. So the router would then understand that addresses from 128, for example, to 255, or 129 to 254, if we're talking about hosts, would be reachable with that subnet mask. Now, the other thing that's worth mentioning, guys, is that it's quite feasible to shuffle these around and say, well, I want the 256 address or the 250 addresses. I want those on 192.168.5.0. I also want the 128 address pool from 192.168.4.0 to 192.168.4.127. And then I want the 32 address pool from 4.128 to 192.168.4.159. So you can actually put them in different orders in that subnet space as long as they fall on the necessary boundaries, and you make sure that, for example, with your 128 addresses that you need, or your 90 hosts requirement, that you have that either sitting on .0 or .128 in that particular subnet range. Anybody got any conceptual problems or things I'd like clarified? Or perhaps people will come up with those either later today or tomorrow or next week, and you guys can then come back to me and ask me once it's all had a bit of a chance to sink in. There are accessible subnet calculators. If anybody can find one, you may want to use one to check your work, but it also may show you how the bit patterns fall, which might be useful.
There's one in the notes, but I haven't really tried it. I know the link works.
Alrighty. I know you guys don't want to put your hands up for work, but does anybody want me to write a different subset of questions so that you guys can test your understanding of those, given the fact that I've basically gone through all of these and given you all the answers in class?
I say yes.
Okay. Okay. Well, what I'll do is I will come up with a scenario-based thing about... we'll call it something, and I will give you guys an exercise in which you slice that network up, and you subnet it in such a way to allow the business requirements to exist, and we'll see what people come up with for that, and it should give people a bit of practice. Okay, sorry, I shouldn't drink exceedingly hot chocolate. Exceedingly strong hot chocolate at 9 o'clock last night because I didn't get to sleep till 11, which is always no good. Alrighty. Anybody else got any other pending questions that are outstanding at the moment that that they may have? Has anybody been in and had a look at the remote bundle in the last week or so?
I have not. I meant to, and then didn't.
Hang on, guys. Sorry, somebody just handed me a free thumb drive, which is always good. And that's one of the three free thumb drives you could have got if you had completed the survey. And if you have completed that survey, you will be awaiting your free thumb drive very soon. It's a little wristband. Okay, what's... Friday is Cavi Day. All right. I'll keep that in mind. Now, how many of you... Has anybody here downloaded the Thursday chat on... Imaging up drives with a GRML. Has anybody downloaded that? Okay. There is a... check what for malware?
I am going to.
Ah.
The drive.
Ah, fair enough. Yeah, you can do that. In fact, you can loop mount the thing and do all sorts of nifty things with it. There is one wrinkle if you're imaging up Windows 7. Machines that I discovered over the weekend because I've been playing with Windows 7. You also need to back up cylinder 0 of the hard drive, and in the Olympus version that I will be doing, I will actually show you how to do that, because the Windows 7 bootloader is actually bigger than the Windows XP bootloader, which means you do actually have to image up track 0 as well, otherwise you don't get the full bootloader. It is repairable, but you need to boot off the Windows 7 disks and do a recover the bootloader step, which is not really easy to do if you can't see. So that's a little... No, I don't think it is for Vista, actually. I believe the loader actually changed in... Actually, it might be for Vista 64-bit editions, because Vista 64-bit editions have the ability to run from either standard MS-DOS partition tables or GPT or EFI partition tables, which Windows 7 can do. It can run off EFI as well. But I don't believe you have to image up track 0 if you're cloning Vista. I don't have any Vista machines, so I haven't actually tried that.
I was always a bit confused at the partitioning. I mean, I've done this 5 times and I'm still confused as to the partitioning, what you need to get Windows 7 to work, because I know it makes its own partition, and I remember once I tried to put it on with an NTFS partition and it complained, and it had to make another one and wipe out everything that was there, and I don't know why to this day, but I didn't see it at all, so I had to make a new one.
You need to change the partition type to partition type 7 if you're doing the partitioning under Linux. What I ended up doing was I actually cloned one of my netbooks across onto another, and to be able to do that, I created a partition of the necessary size. I made it partition type 7, and then I undid the clone onto that partition, and I marked that partition as active, and it all went like a mad thing. It didn't have a problem at all. Windows 7 came up and booted. What it makes during install, I really can't say. It may need to make a temporary partition when it's actually installing from the CD. I have done my installs upgrading from a previous edition of Windows, and I think if you update from a previous edition of Windows, it can use the existing partition to store its temporary files. But sadly, that has nothing to do with exploration, so we should possibly take the exploration rocket down from Planet Garden Path and put it back onto planet Let's Discuss Ethernet. Okay, I'll just put myself on autovox because my finger's getting a little bit tired from holding down the scroll lock key, so I'll be with you all in a second. Okie doke, we are now on autovox. Now the other thing that people said as well, and Gemma mentioned this, and it's probably worth mentioning, it may not be feasible for you to do a live demonstration of the voice because Ventrilo isn't stereo, but you could always pre-record it, and we'd be more than happy to take some MP3 content that was in stereo that you had pre-recorded previously. So that's another way of doing it, and then we could mix that in with, so we could have a question time or something if people wanted to get on and ask you questions once they'd heard it. So that's just a thought on the voice presentation.
Okay.
Yeah, that was why I recorded the Team Talk one from my stereo mix, so that we could understand that, you know, you could hear the stereo-ness and good times for the 3D positioning and such.
I must say the idea of dragging you around in the stereo field is somewhat appealing, Mr. Drew, but there you go.
I think the mute function would be even better, which I didn't... Oh, I forgot to demo that. Oh, well.
There's a very old joke in one of the lectures where my wife at the time was muted, and I made the point that that was probably a good thing, and could we have this in real life? But that was back in 2007's lectures. Alrighty, let's move on to a chapter 9. Now, I'm looking at a lot of these labs, and they're just plain crummy. I'm going to go through and modify the ones that are actually modifiable, but some of them are just like, build this horrendously large simulated packet tracer thing and watch how the collisions happen. But given the fact that you can't really watch how the collisions happen for obvious reasons, otherwise you wouldn't be studying with us, we're going to have to come up with some alternate or different way of people understanding that. Chapter 9 talks about the various implementations of Ethernet. Now, essentially, this is a fairly notes-heavy chapter. There are some things that I will talk about that come from that chapter, but essentially a lot of it is just raw figures and data and all that sort of stuff, so generally speaking, it's one of those things you'd really want to read. We're going to talk about Ethernet in relevance to the OSI reference model because it takes care of layers 1 and 2 of the OSI reference model. We can't really talk about it in relation to the TCP/IP model because all of the Ethernet stuff exists in the network access layer of the TCP/IP model. Ethernet works at layers 1 and 2. We have layer 1 being the physical layer, and layer 2 being the... Can anybody tell me what layer 2 is?
Data link.
Yes, and Josh gets the virtual Turkish Delight chocolate bar for saying data link. Okay, the original Ethernet standard was done in 1980. Robert Metcalfe and his guys all got together and did all this research, and they came up with an Ethernet standard which was known as the DIX standard. The reason it was known as DIX was because it was standardized by Digital Equipment, Intel and Xerox. But to allow vendor cooperation, it was released as an open standard. In 1985, IEEE standardized 802.3, but they had to make a couple of changes in the field and stuff. They, instead of being a length field, it became a type field. Basically, the data link layer is subdivided into the logical link control and the media access control layers. So that's the MAC and the LLC layers. Okay, so layer one is the physical bits and voltages and stuff on the cable. MAC sub one layer handles the physical components, which is like the hardware on your network cards and stuff. And the logical link control is what handles putting the level 3 protocol data units into frames and sticking on the MAC addresses and all of that sort of good stuff. Can anybody remember how long is a MAC address? 48 bits, which makes it 12 hexadecimal digits, usually written in 6 pairs of 2. Now, layer 1 cannot communicate with upper layers easily, like the layers that are like 3 and stuff, as such, without going through layer 2. It cannot identify devices specifically, it can just put bits on the wire. It only recognizes streams of bits. And it cannot figure out where the transmission is coming from if multiple devices are transmitting. Now, we have layer 2 functions. It connects to upper layers using logical link control. It uses addressing schemes to recognize devices, which is your MAC addresses. It uses frames to organize bits into groups. Remember, we said the layer 2 PDU was a frame. Uses media access control to identify transmission sources. Any questions on any of that so far? Has anybody actually read this chapter, just out of morbid curiosity? Okay. No. You're probably all busy messing around with subnetting and that horrible exercise that we've been covering and may not have actually gotten to reading Chapter 9. Well, I mean, I can't talk. I only got to reading it last night, so there you go. Now, the 802.2 standard describes the LLC standard stuff, and the 802.3 explains the media access control stuff and the physical layer functions. The LLC makes the connection with the upper layers, frames the network layer packet, identifies the network layer protocol, and remains relatively independent of the physical equipment. Anybody got any questions on that? So the easiest way to remember this is media access control. That concerns itself with physical stuff and the cables and the bits and all that sort of stuff, because it concerns itself with physical media. We have some examples of physical media. 10 base 5, which is thick coax, and it can go a maximum of 500 metres. 10 base 2, which can go a maximum of 185 metres. 10 base T, which can go 100 metres. And you can get 100 base TX and all that sort of good stuff. 1,000 base CX can go 25 metres, which is fibre. And you can get gigabit twisted pair, which can go 100 metres as well. And it has a list of fiber connectors and stuff, which I won't go through all of them. Okay. Now, let's see. What else have I got in my document here? Okay, the MAC layer encapsulates data, provides three primary functions: frame delimiting, addressing, and error detection. Can anybody tell me what is the thing that detects the errors on Ethernet? Does anybody remember? I think I've mentioned it a few times before.
You mean a stop bit?
No, that tells us when the transmission is actually stopped. Well, that would be the end of frame delimiter. Yeah. A clue. The acronym is FCS.
Oh, yeah, I remember. Checksums.
Yes, technically the frame check sequence.
CRC?
Yep, the frame check sequence is in fact a 32-bit cyclic redundancy checksum. And you can actually look that up if you're that bored. But CRCs are mind-bogglingly complicated things that give you a number that changes a lot as the data goes through it. And when that happens, it changes a lot, and you can actually detect an error based on whether the frame check sequence matches or not. Framing shows where frames start and end. Also, MAC addresses and or hardware addresses are added to the frames. The CRC is sent at the end of the frame, and if the CRC matches, there is a high probability, quite high, that the frame has been received without error. Ethernet is popular because it has the ability to... it's simple and it's easy to maintain, generally speaking. You can incorporate new technologies into it. It's reliable, generally speaking. Low cost of installation and upgrade. Now, has anyone on this channel at the moment not got an Ethernet of some description in their house? Is anyone purely wireless? Okay, now, frames remain the same. So the actual framing of Ethernet is the same from 10 megabit half duplex all the way up to 1,000 megabit full duplex. Obviously, the bit times get shorter and shorter and shorter. The bit time is how long it sends takes to send one bit. At 10 megabit, it takes 100 nanoseconds to send a bit. At 100 megabits, it takes 10 nanoseconds. At 1,000 megabits, it takes 1 nanosecond to send a bit. So certainly not time to duck out and get a coffee. The original Ethernet was actually used in Hawaii, and it used... the Aloha radio network, which was designed to send signals between the Hawaiian Islands. It wasn't very efficient, but it basically used the carrier sense multiple access with collision detection system that I talked about a couple of weeks ago. Each station listens for a period of silence. If it finds a period of silence, it then starts transmitting. It then looks for any other collisions that may be happening at the same time. If a collision exists, it sends a jamming signal. The machines back off for a random amount of time and then retry the transmission procedure. Now, the original Ethernet used a physical and a logical bus topology. So physically, all of the computers were connected onto one big run of coax, and logically, the media was shared by all stations. So if you're using hubs, or you're using a run of a thick or thin coax, all systems were on one piece of shared media, which meant every machine could see every packet that was being sent on that media. And the way you decided whether the packet was destined for you was, if it was a broadcast packet, you would have a look at it, or if it was destined to your MAC address or one of the multicast MAC addresses that you might happen to be listening to. The problem with the physical bus is that as the number of devices increased, the number of collisions, retries, backoffs, and jamming signals increased to the point where the performance of the network suffered. On high count networks with lots of machines connected to a shared physical bus, you would end up with a situation where you can actually have 50% of the network bandwidth being eaten purely by collisions and jamming signals alone. Now, a hub, which is also called a multi-port repeater, is a device that takes a signal from one port and reflects it out to all other ports on the hub, and the hosts connect into the hub, and that makes a logical star, which means that, it makes a physical star. It's still a logical bus, I should say. It's a physical star because everything hooks into the hub, but it's a logical bus because the signal is still sent out to all of the other hosts connected to the hub, and that makes the collision zone larger. Now, as the bandwidth requirements increase and the number of hosts increases, the collisions increase, which is why switching was introduced into networks, because it can minimize or in many cases eliminate the causes of collisions. Modern installations use gigabit Ethernet. You can actually use fiber to extend Ethernet into sort of metropolitan-sized networks. Now, originally, Ethernet was only meant to go inside of a building or from building to building. But obviously, they've managed to extend that, especially with some of these fiber systems that can go, you know, 5, 10, 20 kilometers. The Ethernet 2 and the... And the 802.3 standards define the minimum frame size as 64 bytes. So if you've got less than 64 bytes, you've got to pad the frame. The maximum length of a frame is 1,518 bytes. That includes all bytes from the destination MAC address right through to the frame check sequence. Obviously, the preamble, which is what synchronizes the transmitter and receiver, and the start frame delimiter are not included in this calculation. This was actually expanded to 1,522 bytes in the late 90s to allow virtual local area networks, which we don't talk about. But basically, it's a way of identifying up to 4,094 different networks on the same piece of wire. Has anybody got any questions on any of this so far? Go ahead.
This whole new jumbo frame stuff in gigabit, is that sort of some new RFC that somebody came up with, or is it a deviation from the standard?
I believe it's actually been standardized now. I'm not sure which standard of the 802 standards has okayed it, but it was figured that if you were transmitting at gigabit speeds, you would end up with so much overhead based on the fact that you had 1,518 byte frames, that you could actually get more data through in a given time if you actually increased the size of the jumbo frames. Now, interestingly enough, I've read some research that actually says that using 1,500 byte frames, it is still possible to get throughput of 970 to 980 megabits per second on a gigabit network. So, jumbo frames are generally used to ease the burden on badly designed network hardware, and network hardware that's easier to send larger blocks of data than actually getting the window algorithms and stuff correct, especially with TCP and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, it's interesting because I played with it and I made sure I had all equipment that would support it, and I really didn't see. I mean, my LAN at home isn't huge; it's only got 14 hosts on it, but I didn't notice any performance improvement at all.
It is a fairly marginal thing to notice performance improvement on, and unless you're running gigabit gear, it doesn't really make a difference. Most 100 megabit network cards I've ever seen are able to fully saturate the bandwidth at 100 megabits. In fact, I've had plenty of cases where 97, 98 megabits have been in use on a 100 megabit network, which is pretty good if you ask me. Conversely, though, I have had situations where gigabit networking has only been able to shovel, say, 20 to 25 megabytes a second, and it requires some significant fiddling to get that number higher. And I'm still actually working on what is actually causing the problem with that. I'm not quite sure what's going on my network, but there are people who've got up to 70 or 80 megabytes a second across the network at any given time. But once you start getting to those speeds, you're really starting to look at... often the network isn't actually the limiting factor. It's obviously the I/O capacity of your computers. And the speed from your disks to your machine, and the speed that machine can shuffle stuff out onto the network. Now, a lot of people won't really care about this. The other thing to keep in mind is that in certain situations when not configured correctly, Samba can be significantly slower than what your network can actually run at. So if you're copying stuff around with Windows, it can be a lot slower than what you'd think. And a lot of those little NAS boxes and stuff have got a little chip in them that's only good for about 14 megabits a second anyway, or even less, even though the box might say it goes faster. So even though the NAS port will run at 100 megabits per second, you might only see 2 or 3 megabytes a second through the actual network attached storage. So it really comes down to you get what you pay for.
Now, the reason is that all because of network overhead, like the TCP/IP stuff and the, you know, the framing and all that? Is that why the speeds are so much lower?
No, it's because the chips just aren't capable of running at the higher speeds. They're a little underpowered chip that was produced in mass and put into a cheap network attached storage box that was under $60 to buy from Best Buy. We could probably put 5 to 10% overhead with the TCP headers and everything on top of the Ethernet framing and stuff, which isn't a huge amount. And obviously with jumbo frames, that would reduce the number of the overhead significantly as well. The other thing to keep in mind, however, though, is that Windows XP, if you're still running it, is not optimized by default to do windowing over higher latency links than fast local area networks, and you'd need a copy of Dr. TCP or to Google yourself through some broadband forums to actually tweak your network settings to allow large windows and to also allow window scaling and a few of the other RFC extensions. Not for the faint of heart. If your network works, I would recommend that if you are going to mess with it, that you take a registry backup, and perhaps if your network's working, it may not be necessary for you to mess with it at all. Now, the length slash type field in the Ethernet is a bit unusual. If it's less than 1500 bytes, it shows the length of the packet. And if it's greater than 1536 bytes, it shows the it actually shows the packet type, whether it's a TCP packet, an IPX packet, an AppleTalk packet, etc. If the packet has a CRC error on receive, it's dropped, and then higher level protocols need to organise retransmission. Any questions on any of that so far? Okay, now MAC address is broken into two portions. 24 bits of it are the organizational unique identifier, and the other 24 bits are the unique serial number of the card. Now, I run an interesting daemon on my Linux boxes, and if you happen to run Linux, I'd strongly recommend this one. It's called ARPWatch, and basically it watches the machines that come onto your network. And when new ones show up, or the IP addresses change on machines that you've already got, or that, it will actually send you an email and say, new station 192.168.24.128, and it'll give you the MAC address, and if it knows who made the network card. Very useful. Now, a unicast frame goes directly to a specific MAC address. So if you're sending a packet to one host, you put the destination MAC address of that particular host into the frame, and off it goes, and it's taken off the wire and accepted by that particular host. The broadcast MAC address is all ones. So it's FFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFFF broadcast frame, and you use broadcast frames for certain things such as ARP who has requests, which we talk about later in the chapter. The non-specific broadcast for a local network segment is 255.255.255.255.
DHCP often... Who assigns these organizational bits?
You register them with IEEE. if you make network cards or networking equipment, you actually register for a prefix from IEEE, and then once you've got a prefix, or in Intel's case, I think they've got 4 or 5 different prefixes, you can then allocate serial numbers as various cards to that prefix. For some reason, I can't actually...
Much better.
Okie dokie. We'll look at that later. Now, hubs known as multi-port repeaters because obviously they repeat the signal to all of the ports. Okay. When hubs are connected together, they create an extended star. They create an extended star physically, but they are still a logical bus, so you end up with lots of collisions and you end up with problems with the performance dropping off. As distances get longer, latency increases and devices need to listen longer for collisions. And if you don't detect a collision within the first 64 bytes of the packet, it turns into a late collision, and that is very difficult to detect with the network hardware, so Ethernet tries to avoid that. It's also worth mentioning that devices must wait 96 bit times between frames to allow the media to settle down and stabilize before the next frame is transmitted. Now, I think I'm actually going to stop there, guys, because I think we've done a fair bit for today, and I'll do the actual specific cable bits and stuff once people have had a chance to read the chapter, and then I'll talk about switches and microsegmentation and all of that good stuff. Has anybody got any questions before I hit the stop button?